This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. Fire up the DeLorean. We're going back in time. The history of WWE.com proudly presents the History of Wrestling podcast right here on Place to Be Nation.
Welcome, everybody, to the premiere episode of the History of Wrestling podcast right here on the Place to Be Nation. I'm Graham Coffin of the History of WWE.com. I want to welcome you guys for being here. I've got Brad Stutz and Dan McGinn here with us. Hey guys, how you doing today?
Wonderful.
Oh, excellent.
Well, it's a big weekend coming up with the Royal Rumble, but it's also been a big week of news over here the past week or so with some pretty historic stuff regarding a pretty historic arena that we'll be talking about here shortly. But I wanted to do this to start us off. This is the first episode, and I'm not so naive to think that there are folks out there that know about this website that we've kind of concocted and what it is and why it is and what it does. The history of WWE.com is something I dreamt up about 12, 13 years ago, actually 13. And the whole goal here is to document every show that not only the WWE has put together, but several other major companies. And through that, we've been able to launch a successful book line. This weekly, we now have a store on Pro Wrestling Tees. So check out the history of WWE.com. There's a link up there. Take it right to it. And if you're a fan of WWE, WCW, NWA, ECW, even TNA, Smoky Mountain, Ring of Honor, you can find the stuff that made you a fan on this website. So really detailed day-by-day accounts of how these organizations ran. Dan, why don't you tell us about how folks can find this show?
Oh, absolutely, Graham. You can find the History of Wrestling podcast in any of the following ways by visiting placetobenation.com and clicking on the PTBN podcast banner. And Graham, actually, I believe they might even make a banner with your face on it that they can
click
on as well.
We don't need to do that. There's no need to do that.
That's the hot rumor. Anyway, for right now, we're going to say the PTBN podcast banner on the right-hand side. In addition, just by subscribing to the Place to Be podcast feed on iTunes, you will automatically receive the latest episodes of the History of Wrestling podcast. You can also visit the folks at Stitcher, stitcher.com, and subscribe to the Place to Be podcast and download the Place to Be Nation podcast app. And you can hit that up by going to placetobe.podbean.com/mobile on your iPhone or iPad. Be sure to follow us on Twitter. It's at the History of WWE and at Place to Be Nation. And like us on Facebook at facebook.com/placetobenation. Finally, if you have questions or suggestions for this program, you could tweet us at Stutzy, at DMACPTB2B. Wow, I screwed up my own Twitter handle. That's great. And, of course, at History of WWE, and be sure to use the hashtag HOW Podcast.
HOW Podcast. I really hope I don't see an ad with my face on it. That's awkward. You guys got to admit that. I mean, I have good hair, but it's still awkward.
That's above my pay grade.
I saw an ad with your face on it on one of those websites at, like, 3 o'clock in the morning one time. I've been meaning to talk to you about that. What?
Was it? How much was it per minute?
It was very tastefully done.
Because here's the thing: I don't get very high commission on that.
I believe you.
So that's why I'm looking to do other things.
You looked cute with your little fig leaf, though. I thought that was a nice touch.
Was it me or my little action figure guy?
That was definitely you.
Okay.
Can I follow the action figure guy?
He does not have a Twitter right now. He's not old enough.
Well, geez, Steve Corino's son is like a 1-year-old kid, and he has a Twitter.
I am not going to come on my brand new show and speak ill of Steve Carino as a parent, but I could. I don't think it's my place, but I could. No, I say that completely joking. One thing I really wanted to kind of start the intro of the show by talking about why this show is going to exist and the purpose of this show. There's a lot of shows out there that talk about pay-per-views and recaps of pay-per-views and talk about upcoming pay-per-views and old TV and whatever, and that's cool. And then we don't want to take over what they're already doing. What I want this show to be is kind of a discussion-driven piece about a historical topic. And that doesn't have to be a certain show. That doesn't have to be – I mean, that could be as simple as an entire territory. So it's going to be, I think, a little bit bigger picture than what folks are used to. But that's why this show exists. That's what's going to make this show a little bit different than what maybe you're used to. And we're going to kick off this show by talking about a pretty big topic. It's been in the news here in the past couple of days. It's the impending closing of the Izod Center, also known as the Meadowlands, one of the premier historical wrestling venues dating back well before any of us were born. And that's going to be – that was tentatively going to be the host site of SummerSlam this year. So WWE is looking to see what other venues they have available. Guys, real quick before we get into the meat and potatoes of the discussion, what I guess was your introduction to the Meadowlands as a fan?
I think the first time that I consciously remember weekly television on Saturday morning talking about the Meadowlands, because like I've talked about before, I grew up in North Carolina, so I wasn't in the area where you would see the big cards plugged. But Ric Flair recapturing the World Heavyweight Championship from Sting, January 1991 at the Meadowlands, was probably like the first time that I remember it. And kind of going back and flipping through the books and flipping through the website, I see a lot more famous cards that predated that, that were held at the Meadowlands, that I definitely watched and enjoyed. But as far as something that early on in my childhood really like gave that venue a special aura about it, that was it. And I think that's something that's kind of lost on the current generation of fans, is, you know, the titles change on Raw and things like that. Like, to be, you know, 7 or 8 years old and to watch wrestling on Saturday morning and see that the World Heavyweight Championship changed hands at this venue, gives, or at least back then it gave that place a very special aura about it. You knew that it was an important special venue if the world title changed there.
And also important to note, that was not a televised card, but they had TV cameras at ringside because it was going to be such a historic card.
Yeah, for me, I was really starting to get into wrestling in the late 80s. And I did another show where some Survivor Series 1989 was kind of like my coming out party as far as wrestling goes. But in preparation for that, was able to acquire via my local video store a copy of, and we're probably going to be talking about this a lot, so I'm not going to belabor the point, but SummerSlam 1989, the enthusiasm in which Tony Schiavone welcomed us to this big event really made it feel like a big deal. This was kind of around the time where pay-per-views were really hard to come by. You had to wait months and months, and you had to like beg your parents to get it on cable, you know, contact your local cable company and that sort of thing. And just the look of that arena and how crazy the crowd was and how exciting it was. You know, we had the big main event and all that, and we'll get into that, but it just looked special. It looked like something that was more than just what I would see on Saturday morning. You had like different colored banners. You had, you know, a larger spectrum of camera angles. It was just like, hey, this Meadowlands place looks pretty cool. Certainly different from the dark and dreary looking Boston Garden back in those times. So that was probably my introduction to the arena.
Well, Brett, I know you being a North Carolina guy, did you ever have the chance to go? Actually, why don't you talk about your WrestleMania 29 story? Because I think that's a perfect one for this.
WrestleMania 29, we did the stadium, but not Raw. And I never get to do Raw. I travel with people that have, you know, jobs and children and all that. But I thought, you know, it was very interesting in the sense that, and we talked about this when it happened back on the old show, on Wrestling with Optimism, that in a lot of ways, the Raw the night after was a more satisfying card as a viewer, where more kind of exciting, cool things happened on that card that was held at the Izod Center. They, you know, WrestleMania that year was WrestleMania, and it's always a huge event. But we talked about it back then, and that night after WrestleMania card holds up just as well, if not better, than the pay-per-view card. And it really creates an interesting kind of spectrum for the discussion when you think about the biggest events that have been held at that venue. You know, does a modern day after WrestleMania card, with everything WrestleMania is and everything that it's become, does that hold up with big cards from the 80s and big pay-per-views from the 80s and 90s? I don't know, but I think it's an interesting place for the discussion. Is the Raw after WrestleMania, has it become big enough now that a good one like that one holds up in its place among the more historic cards from the 80s and 90s and beyond?
I think it does, and the reason I say that, it's not just my own personal take, but I was asking some of our fans on Facebook and some of our followers on Twitter a day or two before we were taping this show, what is your favorite memory from the Izod Center? Making sure to also tell them, you know, this is the Meadowlands. This is the same place that has been, you know, being run for 30-plus years. And several of those responses were stemming from that Raw, Ziggler cashing in. And that speaks to what kind of following you get on social media. You tend to get a younger fan base. But even still, I thought that spoke to something. Dan, have you ever been to the venue?
I have, actually, but not for wrestling, believe it or not. I was actually talking about this with Brad before we went on the air. The one time I actually went to the building, and I'm not sure if you care or not, but it stuck in my mind, and that was for a Weezer concert. And I was doing some research on this Weezer concert, and it turned out it got panned by MTV. There was a columnist who said that it was not a very good show, but I enjoyed myself. I got an underage beer underage, which was great, and you know, I was always a big Weezer fan. But that's probably not what you wanted to talk about.
No, but I was curious as to if you ever been there firsthand. Yeah. I was able to go once, and it was oddly enough day after WrestleMania. It was the day after WrestleMania 20, and at that point, the day after WrestleMania, Raw did not have the same aura as it does now. It was a fine show, but it was more of a paint your numbers. Hey, this big show just happened. Now we're going to kind of tease the next big show. But there was nothing big to the show by itself, other than maybe seeing, you know, Benoit come out with the belt for the first time, which was kind of cool. And I remember, for someone that's not used to the downtown New York City environment, I remember going and getting the bus and catching the bus, and the bus taking you from New York City, across the bridge to the Meadowlands. You get off the bus, there's the big football stadium, there's the arena, then after the show you get back right back on. And I remember getting taking the bus ride back after the show. There were so many rowdy people on the bus, and they were all wrestling fans. They all just had come from the show, but they were so rowdy and standing up and getting the bus driver agitated that I thought at some point we were going to drive off the bridge and all die. That thought actually occurred to me, and I thought to myself, well, I mean, the trip has just begun, but WrestleMania is pretty awesome. Got to see the Garden. I'm okay. Whatever. Speaking of the Garden.
Call it a good life.
Yeah. I mean, I'm... Yeah, it's kind of pitiful to look back now and say that, but yeah. I mentioned the Garden, and there's kind of an inherent relationship there between the two venues, because for many, the Meadowlands and the Garden are so close together that that some might actually consider the Meadowlands as like the little brother or the little sister of the Garden. During the mid-80s, when the big wrestling war was going on, obviously the WWF and the McMahons had the Garden locked in. No one else was going to run there. So what did the NWA and the AWA do? They ran the Meadowlands just down the road, maybe 10 miles away. And it was hitting that same fan base. It was hitting that same demographic. It just wasn't the same arena. And I thought that was really smart. And if you look back at the history of the Meadowlands, I mean, first of all, before I talk about the NWA and AWA, the Pro Wrestling USA partnership, it's important to note that the debut show, the first show that the WWF ran at the Meadowlands, was Bruno Sammartino's retirement. That was his last match as a full-time wrestler. It was against George Steele on October 4, 1980. What do you guys think about that?
I think that really speaks to the relationship between the two venues, like you're talking about. I think to have a major event like that take place in basically the first time coming to this venue, I think it plays very well to what you were talking about, and that them wanting to kind of link the two and let people know that, you know, major events and major things are going to take place at this venue in a way very similar to the Garden. I think it speaks very well to that little brother kind of relationship like you touched on.
Yeah, and that's basically, again, still part of the extended backyard, if you will, of Bruno and his reign and his run. And maybe you weren't able to get into necessarily the big city all the time, or couldn't get into the Garden. It was always sold out. So for them to kind of, you know, hey, you know what, this place might be a place that we kind of go to as one of our anchor places, you know, over here in the East. Maybe that was a shrewd move on their part to kind of say, hey, Bruno can come here too. And, you know, we're christening this building by celebrating the career of one of our greats.
Well, you said shrewd move, and I think that's a good topic I'm going to build off of. I'm working on a book on the Baltimore Arena, and that was one of those venues in one of those cities that during the 80s was a battleground city. You know, NWA ran there, WWF ran there, AWA ran there, and so they did the same thing at the Meadowlands. And it wasn't long, right in the middle of this wrestling war going all across the country, that the Meadowlands got everything. The Meadowlands got, in 85, Jimmy Garvin and Rick Martel for the AWA title. They got the Road Warriors, they got the Russians, they got Bob Backlund versus Billy Robinson, they got Ric Flair versus Harley Race. And pop quiz for you guys. I'm going to see if you knew this or not. Did you know that the opening scene from Highlander is from the Meadowlands?
I did know that, actually.
Yeah, no chance on that one for me.
Dan, have you seen Highlander?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, the opening where you got Michael Hayes, and it's from a AWA show, I believe. Mm-hmm. That was from April 1985. From the Meadowlands. So it was just really cool that this New York market, you know, traditionally the territory stayed within the territories, but you've got this weird, it's kind of like what MSG was in before this point, where you'd see stars from all over the world. In the Meadowlands, you're seeing big companies from all over the country. And also in 85, Saturday Night's Main Event, Hogan Volkoff. I think at this point, any longtime fan has probably seen that match, that flag match. January 87, we've got WWF Superstars being taped there. And it's notable during this taping that this is the taping where Hogan and Andre get their trophies.
Oh.
So it's not the taping where, you know, Andre rips the cross off. But it's the taping immediately before there, with Hogan gets his giant trophy, Andre gets his little trophy, and then the last episode of the taping was Ventura saying, "Piper, I will bring Andre the Giant out next week if you bring Hulk Hogan," and that's what started everything leading into WrestleMania 3. One thing that kind of came up in a news way, in a very kind of subtle way here recently, with the announcement that Macho Man's going in the Hall of Fame, is a few folks noted that some of the tension between Macho Man and the WWF / Vince McMahon dated back to a Legends Battle Royal in which he wanted his father, Angelo Poffo, to be included and was not. That match, November 1987, was at the Meadowlands. So it just, there's so many things that maybe we don't even think of that were notable, notable matches, notable moments, or just notable in historic sense that took place there. Dan, why don't you talk about SummerSlam 89 for a little bit? Because I think kind of going forward, that's I believe, the first pay-per-view that we get there.
Yeah, first pay-per-view. Obviously a time period near and dear to me, but you had kind of a surprise to some that you got so used to Gorilla and Jesse there being the voices, and to have a different voice in there kind of had that fresh feel, that youthful exuberance of Tony Schiavone. And it was kind of an idea that maybe time had come, because when you look back in the late 80s, you had, you know, Mania, and eventually you had Survivor Series creep up, and you kind of needed something to bridge the gap, as it were, and you got that with SummerSlam back then. And yeah, this was a kind of an odd time, because you still had the Hogan, the Mega Powers exploded, obviously, months earlier, and now you introduce this new character, this literally a character, not so much a wrestler, but the whole aspect of Zeus being part of a main event storyline, the actor who was mad about the ending of a movie and decided to take out his aggressions out in the ring. I don't know, however you want to talk about that.
Not to interrupt, but how awesome would that be to create another character based off of he was upset by how a movie ended?
No kidding. But yeah, it was kind of, at the time, they could feed us something like that, and we would buy it. We would just eat that for dinner. We were all about that sort of thing. It didn't matter to us. We kind of just sort of threw that out the window and said, oh my gosh, is he going to actually be able to hurt this man? This man doesn't seem to, he seems to be impervious to pain. And you just sort of had that that day and age where everybody seemed to get a payday. So you had your main event players, but then you also had your lower card guys. You had your multi-man tag team matches that incorporate a lot of different personalities. You had a couple six-man events. And Graham, you and I talked about this yesterday. You talked about how one of our favorite tag matches ever started this show. So it's a show top to bottom that you can get plenty of entertainment value out of.
And I love the fact that you've got two six-man tags, but they're completely different. One has all the monsters, and one has all the fast guys.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, King Duggan and Demolition, and then, of course, you have Andre, Bossman, and Akeem. A lot of meat in that ring for that particular battle. You even had Duggan in face paint, the American flag 2x4. Just these images that are like, well, I never really thought about that, but here they are. It right there before you. And then, of course, the other six-man event, more technical sound, a little more aerial maneuvers. You had Rockers involved, Tito Santana. This is probably the closest, besides some of the Rumble matches and the rare meetups in Survivor Series, where you had that rivalry of the Strike Force breakup between Martel and Tito. And then, of course, everybody's kind of I think there's a – since I joined Place to Be Nation, I realized there was a appreciation society for the Rougeau brothers that I just never saw when I was watching as a kid. But a lot of people really loved the Rougeaus and what they could do and what they maybe should have done if they were wrestling at a different time period. And they were involved as well. So, like I said, you really got a chance to get a nice snapshot of what the roster looked like right at the end of the 80s, because it seemed like everybody was put on the card because Vince was loyal to his crew.
And that Ultimate Warrior Rick Rude match is probably one of, in my opinion, it's Warrior's best IC match ever.
Yeah, a lot of fun there. Of course, you also had the unintentional humor of before that match of Gene Okerlund dropping an F-bomb on camera, and they had to redo that. But yeah, definitely, and you hear this a lot, Rick Rude gave Warrior some of his best matches. There was a really good feud, you know, the two muscle-bound guys, perfect for Vince at the time. You started the Roddy Piper feud with Rude there, which kind of carried into the fall and winter of that year. And then, of course, I mentioned before the main event. You know, Hogan, Beefcake, Savage, Zeus. Everybody was just the intensity of finding out what Zeus could do in the ring, which we found out wasn't really all that much besides no selling. But how is Hogan going to accomplish the goal of taking out this monster?
So it wasn't long after SummerSlam that actually the WCW started making a big run up in that area, up in the Meadowlands. Brad, talk about that show that you mentioned earlier that was the first one that kind of put the attention on it for you.
Yeah, April of 1990 is when the NWA, WCW, starts trying to run the Meadowlands and try and build that up. They run a couple of more times throughout 1990, and then we get to January 11th, 1991, where Ric Flair defeats Sting for the WCW World Heavyweight Championship. Like I said, for me personally, as a fan, you know, just watching the 605 TV shows or just watching the syndicated shows, you know, I don't think as a young fan now you can really appreciate how much that meant to turn on wrestling on Saturday morning and see that the world title had changed hands at this untelevised event in this venue. It just built it up almost like mythically of like a place that you had to be in, a place that you wanted to see wrestling. They would come back with Flair against Sting in a return in a cage. They would even come back with War Games that summer as throughout the early 90s, WCW still trying to get a foothold in that Northeast market. The Meadowlands was their venue. But quite frankly, if you look at the houses, they were never really able to get that firm grasp on that Northeast market like they would have wanted to.
Yeah, and it's really interesting if you've ever seen, of course, now with the tape trading and DVD trading, folks may have seen it at this point if you didn't see it the first time. But on television back then, some of these Meadowlands shows were hyped up almost like they would be pay-per-views. It didn't matter where you were watching the show. You knew that they were going to the Meadowlands. You knew it was a big event. And I remember that January 91 show, they brought in Lawrence Taylor and hyped the hell out of that, made that to be the biggest thing ever. And he was in Lex Luger's corner. They hyped up Flair and Sting. And they had – I actually just watched earlier, and we'll talk about it later, but there's all sorts of footage that they taped that day to show on their syndicated programs and on their Saturday night program from that show to show the title change and to show Lawrence Taylor and to show how successful WCW can be in the Northeast. And they even I noticed in the crowd were Vladimir and Charlie, who those, you know, big iconic WWF fans that are always ringside at Madison Square Garden. And the WCW came here, made sure to get them front and center to show how cool WCW was and how successful. It's pretty notable also that July 91 show, the War Game show, that was the first public announcement that Ric Flair had been stripped of the title. So that, I think that was the kickoff of the Bash 91 tour.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, I talked a little bit earlier about growing up in the Carolinas, and that was a huge story in Charlotte and in the Carolinas. I was living in Charlotte at the time, and Flair separating from WCW, the news that they were going to strip Flair of the title, and that he was possibly going to the WWF was literally one of the top stories on the evening news. It was a huge, huge story in the Charlotte, you know, market, that area. And like you said, the news was broken at this historic venue where so many amazing events took place.
Funny enough, WCW is running the Meadowlands so often at this point that the WWF pulled out. And they actually stopped running for a good year or 2 years. Now, it should be noted that a couple years earlier, prior to this, the Meadowlands was used when the Madison Square Garden was under renovations. So there was a point, I think in 89 or so, or 90, where MSG was closed the entire summer. And so they basically all the Meadowlands shows kind of became the MSG equivalent. And I think some of those were actually shown on the MSG network in lieu of the shows that would have happened at the Garden. But in 92, the WF finally comes back. And funny enough, I found this earlier. I didn't realize that it took place there. But I don't know if you guys have ever seen the house show footage. I'm a big house show footage guy. If you got fan cam, I want to see it. I mean, if it's in your backyard, I don't want to see it. But if it's from a major event, major company, I would like to see it. 1994 summer saw a few Bret Hart, Owen Hart, Iron Man matches. And you can find footage from Nassau Coliseum, Long Island, of one. And I've seen that one. But there was another one at the Meadowlands, which is kind of funny if you think about it, to have two high-profile matches like that in the same market within probably about a day or two of each other, or roughly the same market. Dan, do you have any strong memories or what are your thoughts on SummerSlam 97? That was the big return by the WWF to that area.
Oh, yeah, so much so. They did a whole big presentation with local politicians. I mean, it was definitely a big deal. In fact, it was something that, in going back, I had to really remember. Like, oh, yeah, it had been a long, long time since we were able to see that arena that I spoke so eloquently about earlier once again on the big stage. And it was a really entertaining card too. You had your Mick, your Mankind, you had your Hunter Hearst Helmsley, you had your Stone Cold and Owen, you had my dog killing a shoe over across the room over here.
I was about to ask who's winning that fight.
Oh my gosh! Well, I mean, my shoe can sell. Let's put it that way. But in any event, I mean, it was a really entertaining for that time period. I really enjoyed the Mankind Triple H stuff during that. Wow, unbelievable. This dog was unconscious when we first started recording, and now he's running all over the place. But anyway,
my dog knows when I'm watching wrestling, and that's when he wants attention.
But
my wife is the same way.
But that opener was, you know, following up from Canadian Stampede was phenomenal, just for those two, and to see Mankind finally get over on Hunter after kind of returning the favor. Months before, I hear the Dude Love music. It was just a very entertaining way to start off this night, and it really capped off well too. I've always enjoyed that main event and the finish. I always thought it was kind of a brilliant way of telling a great story, and I believe Bret and Shawn had a lot to do with that before they wanted to rip each other's throats out. They actually had some good ideas. I mean, the whole visual of Bret spitting on Shawn and Shawn swinging that chair and knocking out Taker and then having to begrudgingly drop the three count to give his arch nemesis the title was just, it was incredible. Probably the last great moment for Bret Hart in the company when you consider what goes on over the next few months. And of course you have the unfortunate memory of realizing that Stone Cold Steve Austin and his broken neck and Owen and how that relationship literally started to fracture once that neck got fractured. So there was a lot going on with this pay-per-view, and it's only fitting that where it all kind of began with the SummerSlam tradition of the SummerSlam previous in the late 80s. Now you have a late 90s show that had a lot of historical significance.
Also, maybe the greatest show open of all time, the open to SummerSlam 97, if you've never seen it, copywritten by Jim Cornette, the Life Isn't Fair show open, maybe one of the greatest show opens of all time for any pay-per-view, completely set the stage beautifully for not just that show, but literally for the months to come.
And I will say, in preparation for doing this show, I think I watched that intro about three times last night.
Yeah, it's amazing. You know, you were talking about fan cams and you know, Bret versus Owen is great and Bruno is great. Look, I'm looking at some of these results. If anyone within the sound of my voice has got the fan cam for October 1, 1992 at the Meadowlands,
I'm gonna I know a guy that was there.
I'm going to need you to send that footage my way. You can keep your Brett versus Owen, keep Bruno. I have got to see The Undertaker, The Ultimate Warrior, and The Boss Man against Nails, Kamala, and Razor Ramon in a six-man tag more than I need my next breath of oxygen. That's how bad I need to see that match if it exists. If that match is out there, send it to me because I need to see those six people in the same match at the same time. Desperate.
And if that match is out there, I want to see it as well. That's one of those things that I think if it did exist, I probably would have come across it at some point just because, one, it shouldn't exist. Just on paper and in the ring, it shouldn't exist. And two, that is so weird that I have to see it.
No, I bet that's the best match ever in the history of the venue. I'll go on record right now and say that that's the best match in the history of the venue. Close the discussion. Wrap the show. It's over. Nothing's going to get better than that six-man match.
Good night, everybody.
That's right. Play the music.
Well, yeah, going off SummerSlam 97, it's pretty cool. If you've seen it, I think most of us have seen it at this point, but on Hitman Hart Wrestling with Shadows, there's a ton of backstage footage from that show to the point where Brett is talking about the finish of his match going, is Sean going to be stealing my heat? And what he should have been told at that moment is, yes, he will.
Affirmative.
Yeah.
But I'm glad you're smart enough to realize it.
No question about it, yeah.
So the next summer, they return with a big show, and it's, I believe it's the first Raw from the Meadowlands, and it's July of 98. And what's notable about this is it's a few things. One is the week before, okay, this is obviously Monday Night War, we're still in the middle of it, and WCW made a big win the week before because they had Goldberg Hogan at the Georgia Dome. Big rating win. So WWF fires back, big show at the Meadowlands. I believe this is the show that they brought Shawn Michaels back after WrestleMania 14, and also had the Outlaws finally losing their belts to Mankind and Kane. So it was a pretty hot crowd. March 2000, Raw comes back. Rock finally earns his WrestleMania title shot. Vince McMahon returns. And Brad, do you want to talk about maybe King of the Ring 2001?
Yeah, absolutely. A show that I think in a slew of great pay-per-views from that time period maybe doesn't get the love that it deserves because if for whatever reason you do not remember or you cannot recall seeing the Kurt Angle Shane McMahon street fight, it's one of the most brutal matches in the history of that company, and I'm not exaggerating that in the slightest. This was the night that Angle wrestled three times and went through the tournament, and then also wrestled Shane McMahon, and those two beat the living shit out of each other, and it's it is on a par with the more perversely entertaining matches in the history of the company, in the sense that it just keeps going and they just keep going at it. You also get a Benoit, Jericho, Steve Austin three-way for the championship that goes nearly a half an hour, that also gets the surprise debut of Booker T defecting over from WCW as part of the invasion. Like I said, there's a lot of those pay-per-views from the late 90s, the early 2000s that are really, really, really strong shows that hold up now, and that's one of them because there's literally good wrestling all the way up and down the card. When they did the Best of the King of the Ring Blu-ray, like three or four matches from that show made it on the cut. It's a very good show, and like I said, it's a show that holds up very nicely even today.
And going back to the invasion angle of that, there had been a few surprise appearances before King of the Ring, but I think really Booker T's appearance, because he was the WCW World Champion, kind of gives it the official kickoff.
Yeah, yeah. You had Lance Storm, you had Bill DeMott, Booker T. Once we saw him and he dropped Austin through the announce table, I think he broke Austin's hand in the process. That was the one that was replayed over and over, and that was the one that they made the biggest spectacle of. And like you said, it felt like the war was on.
And then actually the next night they had Raw at the Garden, and Booker T lays out Vince McMahon in the middle of the ring, and the war was on.
Mm-hmm.
A couple years later, just to kind of run down a few other highlights here. I believe we had the debut of Matt Stryker, who had just been in the news a little bit, and he comes out and answers the Kurt Angle Open Invitational. So the introduction of Matt Stryker on at the Meadowlands. 2009, Tommy Dreamer, who actually used to go there as a fan, has his last WWE match against Zack Ryder on television, and gave that great emotional speech after that match. His wife and kids are in the crowd. And then, of course, now, Dan, were you at the Raw after 29, the one that Brad made the mistake of not attending?
Actually, no. I was still up in Massachusetts. It was on my birthday, incidentally.
Oh.
I just remember when I was sitting there watching it in my room, that kind of got – I'm sure there were kind of that kind of smart crowd before this, but this is the one that gets all the pub, gets all the attention with, like, the different chants and, you know, kind of, like, poo-pooing certain things that weren't the most entertaining, which is probably, like, most of the show now. Speaking from someone who used to write Raw recaps, there's probably a lot that people can crap on during the course of a three-hour show. But at this time, you had, like, the kind of amped-up, probably well-lubricated fans who were really into what was going on. And then when stuff wasn't working, they would let you know, and they'd start cheering things like Michael Cole. But you just had that buzz throughout the entire evening, and you just kind of had that feeling that as soon as the World Heavyweight Championship was out there, the champion was there and doing his thing, that at some point you just could feel that something huge was going to happen. And of course we saw it in the form of Dolph Ziggler and that precious blue briefcase.
And what also that crowd deserves credit for making Fandango a star, a pop culture star.
Very briefly,
but very widespread as well.
Yeah, it got over for a little bit.
I mean, he was even on the iTunes top charts. Did any one of us buy that song on iTunes?
I did not.
No, and I haven't bought the DVD that Fandango's on the cover of, too, for, like, the best music of
WWE. Oh, you don't even have to, because I think they had it on the network.
Oh, well, there you go.
It's one of those Beyond the Ring specials, and it's so bad because I think it's just a countdown of best entrance music, and that's all it is.
I think you're right, and I think I've seen this, like, in most times the DVD, if it's been out for a while, it goes down to, like, $14.99, and then sometimes it goes down even further to $9.99. This one, I think I remember seeing at, like, a Barnes & Noble for, like, $6, like, flat
fee. That's fair.
Yeah, exactly.
It's very similar to what you'd find on WWE Countdown, except it's not WWE Countdown.
Oh, there you go. And I don't watch that show.
But you also get a little glimpse as to how they make the music and, you know, the mindset behind that, and that part's pretty cool. But then it's just kind of and here's the number one song of all time kind of stuff.
I never saw it either, but it seemed like a good idea that kind of got wasted a little bit. I would have liked to have seen a little bit more of an in-depth kind of presentation of it. It seemed like a good idea, but I never saw it either for that reason. It just seemed like a waste of a release to some extent. I would have liked to have seen a little bit more of the hows and the whys, because, like, there's that great scene in Beyond the Mat, where I think it's Beyond the Mat, where they're just talking about making Vader's music, and it's like that stuff is really cool, and how the hows and whys are definitely more interesting, in my opinion, than the actual product itself when it comes to stuff like that.
Right. So, looking back, guys, do you have any favorite memory or what would you say if you were to point a fan or a non-fan towards one of these shows, which would it be?
I think it's got to be SummerSlam 89 in a lot of ways. I think maybe that's just a time that I'm a little more that I romanticize a little bit more, because SummerSlam 97 is fine. But maybe that's just a time that I romanticize a little bit more in our industry or whatever. But I think for all the reasons that Dan said earlier, to me, that's the quintessential event that came from that venue.
It definitely doesn't stand up to the same degree as SummerSlam 89, but I probably, and a lot of people might laugh about this, like, why are you saying that show or that sort of thing, but I almost have to go to, like, just last year, and it will probably go down as the last pay-per-view event in this building, and that would be Extreme Rules. I mean, you take a look at it on paper, and you're like, oh, I don't really think I care for that. I might not even watch that again on the network. But when you consider that there was a Shield Evolution match, which we were always entertaining when the Shield were together, you know, kind of big spots fest, but still, you know, something that was memorable at the time. You had kind of that creepy weirdo finish in the cage with Wyatt and Cena. But at least at the time, you were like, wow, you might have got a little excited about Wyatt because, hey, he won, even though it was kind of a weird situation. And then, of course, it was Daniel Bryan's basically last match until very recently. You know, he had to just kind of had the momentum of winning the title, and then he gets put with Kane. But for what it's worth, it was a pretty interesting, pretty entertaining way to finish off a show. He had kind of that dive off of the forklift spot, which was pretty dangerous if you think about all the different surgeries and such that Bryan went through. So I don't know. If I had both of them, you know, and I only had one show to watch, yeah, I'd probably go with SummerSlam 89, but just for the historical aspect of it, it's probably going to be the last big show there. Why not Extreme Rules 2014?
And I'm glad you brought that up, because it was so recent, it completely slipped my mind. But I thought that was a fun show coming off of WrestleMania 30, which I thought it was just an exceptional, phenomenal show.
Yeah, I think the Extreme Rules shows in the past couple of years have been really good at kind of capitalizing on the momentum of WrestleMania, or sometimes, like I remember the Daniel Bryan Sheamus, sometimes the Extreme Rules, you could argue, gets it right, where WrestleMania, they didn't have time or inclination to really fulfill on the promise. Sometimes Extreme Rules ends up fulfilling on the promise of WrestleMania and delivering a classic return match from the WrestleMania program.
Right, but I think last year they did get it right. Guys, why don't we take a break, and we come back, and we'll wrap up talking about the Meadowlands a little bit, and then get into some other fun stuff.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation, placetobenation.com, The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner, at least we hope.
Hey, this is Bauer from The Bauer Show, sports and more. You can check out The Bauer Show podcast every Wednesday and Friday right here at placetobenation.com.
The Bauer Show.
Chad, do you hate it when commercials one and run?
What do you mean, Parv?
Oh, never mind.
Listen to Where the Big Boys Play on placetobenation.com and find us on iTunes. We are the only WCW Supercard exclusive podcast.
Greetings, friends. Ben Morse from Place to Be Nation's Main Event here. Tired of other podcasts constantly stuck in the past? Every other week, we give you a roundtable discussion of what's happening in wrestling today. Place to Be Nation's Main Event. We're holding everybody else down.
Looking for something different in your pro wrestling podcasts? Look no further than the Pro Wrestling Super Show. Join me, Stephen Graham, every week as I'm joined by a rotating door of guests as we discuss a single topic each show, ranging from ECW pay-per-view reviews, wrestler snapshots, top six lists, and anything else you can think of. That's the Pro Wrestling Super Show every week here on the Place to Be Nation.
So you got the script, yeah? You all got it?
Yeah.
Oh, that sounds terrible. The Titans of Wrestling... Oh, brilliant.
Sorry.
The Titans are wrestling off.
Pete, I'm a lead analyst for show and breakdown matches.
Kelly, lead historian. I'm a jobber lover. Are you?
Johnny and I drink.
And yes, me, Bob. We watch old school wrestling and love it.
Titans of Wrestling.
You know you want to hear it.
What's going on? This is the Godfather, Nate Milton, with an offer you cannot refuse. Each and every week, join Marcus Vandenberg and myself for the world's most dangerous sports show and the program that's changing the game one show at a time, the Kings of Sport Podcast. Available exclusively on placetobenation.com, your one-stop spot for the best in sports and pop culture.
Hey, sports fans, this is Dr. G for Extra Point, Place to Be Nation's traditional sports talk podcast. Every episode, Scott Criscullo and I talk everything from the big four leagues to all the hot sports news with exclusive guests and analysts. Email us your comments and questions at extrapoint@placetobenation.com. That's the Extra Point, exclusively on placetobenation.com.
Hey, sports fans, Cowboy here. Make sure you make your weekly stop by the Sports Lounge here on placetobenation.com, where the boys and I tackle all the hot topics in the world of sports. We go behind the numbers and provide in-depth expert analysis on Major League Baseball, MMA, NFL, and more. The seats fill up quick, so grab your favorite cigar, kick back, and join us in the Sports Lounge, only on placetobenation.com.
In Rhode Island, and looking for great food and a fun atmosphere, we'll be sure to stop by Bonehead's Wing Bar, 131 Washington Street in West Warwick, with over 65 different wing sauces and dozens of sandwiches, burgers, and appetizers. And a fully stocked bar, Bonehead's has something for everyone. Boneheads also shows every WWE and UFC pay-per-view, features live music, weekly trivia, and much, much more. So, be sure to stop in, tell Matt and the crew that Place to Be Nation sent you, and become a Bonehead today.
Hey, this is Rob Naylor. Do you still enjoy pro wrestling? Believe it or not, I still do. So you better join myself and Will on the Google Wrestling Podcast, exclusively at PlaceToBeNation.com.
Shit, I wasn't ready. Hey, this is Will. If you like listening and shit. Hey, this is Will. If you like listening to guys talk about old school wrestling, follow me and Charles on Wrestling with the Past podcast on Place to Be Nation.
What's up, wrestling fans? This is Jeff Peck, and you can check out my wrestling podcast, The Still Real to Us Show, every Saturday right here at PlaceToBeNation.com. It is a wrestling podcast from a fan's perspective. And we're not doing it in our mom's basement. So check it out every Saturday right here at PlaceToBeNation.com.
It's still real to me, damn it!
Looking for new wrestling, sports, and pop culture voices? Head over to PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. We have an extremely talented staff that covers comics, video games, and all facets of entertainment. Our sports coverage spans all the major professional and collegiate sports, including MMA. Our fresh takes on professional wrestling are some of the best on the internet. Also, be sure to check out our friends at thehistoryofwwe.com, prowrestlingonly.com, Scott Keith blog at rspwfaq.net, and piledriverwrestling.net.
Welcome back. I hope you guys will check out all those 38 different podcasts here on the Place to Be Nation. Actually, I think that number is closer to 119. But they are all quality programs. If I could just sit on my couch by myself with no interruption, I would just listen to all of them one day, and I think you should too. So we were talking about the Meadowlands, and toward the end of its closing, one thing that I did not remember at that point, but I think it's worth including, is back in 2013 when the WWE was up there for WrestleMania weekend, they used the Izod Center for access. So while this very historic building is about to close, thankfully a lot of these younger talents that are coming up right now did have the opportunity to perform there as part of access, such as Adrian Neville and I'm looking at these names to see who's still there. Bo Dallas, Corey Graves, Paige, Summer Rae. So a lot of names that are just now getting a lot of momentum behind them. did have the opportunity to perform at the Meadowlands before it closed. And I think that's pretty cool. And I think looking back, they will think that's pretty cool too. You guys kind of touched on your picks for, say, a favorite event there. And I'm looking at the list, and it's a long list, and it's a pretty vital list. And it runs the gamut from old school early 1980s to the height of the wrestling war of 80, quote unquote, of 84. And even I think the Highlander inclusion is pretty interesting as well. If I was to pick one, it's a SummerSlam. I just don't know which one. Add 89 plus 97, divide by 2.
A lot of
just
guys
right in the middle somewhere.
What about 07? We haven't talked about 07 yet.
Because it was sucked. I think that's why I skipped it entirely. But yeah, we can certainly talk about it. It was historical. It didn't blow me away.
No, I didn't really, except for compiling a list. I was like, wow, it's kind of like forgotten that, oh yeah, by the way, 2007 was also part of the SummerSlam party. It's just the one that that no one wants to talk to or talk about. It's kind of sitting in the corner partying by itself.
Well, I think,
hey guys,
really,
you want to hang out?
I think that really shows that wrestling in the modern era, you just don't develop the same attachment for a major show as you did in the 80s or the 90s. Because, I mean, this is a show that, you know, SummerSlam 2007, you know, over 17,000 people in the building, a $1 million gate. This is a show that was, you know, released on DVD. Like, this should be one of the very first, you know, major shows that you think of when you think of this building. You know, Triple H coming back off of a long layoff, and you know,
Rey Mysterio doing the same.
Absolutely, like this is a relatively big card, and there's just not that same affection for a big show in the modern era, because there's going to be another one in at least a month. Sometimes, like we were talking about earlier with the Raw after WrestleMania, sometimes there's another big card in 24 hours. Mm. And it makes it a lot harder to have a real attachment to these shows in the modern era. But, you know, depending upon your perspective of things, that, you know, probably should belong in the conversation of the biggest shows in the history of that venue. Like I said, over 17,000 people there, over $1 million at the gate, 537,000 pay-per-view buys. Like, this is a card. This is a pretty beefy, meaty card. And, you know, we all but ignored it just because it doesn't have that same affection to us as those 80s and 90s cards.
Well,
it's just hard to get excited about them.
I will not disagree with one word that you said. But I think if you look at Extreme Rules last year, it kills that SummerSlam.
Well, yeah, I agree with that.
Well, thanks to your site, Graham, I know that if I didn't want to watch the whole card and I didn't have the network and I still collected DVDs, if I had the Triple H Thy Kingdom Come, I could watch the Triple H Return bout with Booker T. And then I do have the John Cena experience, so I could relive Cena versus Orton over and over and over again. It's hard for me to really get excited for another Batista versus Great Khali. If there is a place in wrestling hell for me, it would be me, a cell, a TV, and nothing but Great Khali in the main event picture. That's, or maybe even not even in the main event picture. It could be him singing, it could be him dancing.
Would you be in a cell, or would you be in a Punjabi prison?
Oh, good. I didn't think about that, but yeah, that probably would be where I'd be.
The match from Extreme Rules 2014 that we really need to talk about is El Torito against Hornswoggle.
That was a pretty amazing match.
That's the match.
That's no sarcasm.
No sarcasm whatsoever. Like, that's the match from that show, even more so than the Shield match, even more so than whatever. That's the match that I will remember beyond even Bryan's first title defense against Kane. because those two went out there like they had something to prove and had a hell of a match.
And proved it.
Yeah,
and won over that crowd. And live tweeting it, won over a lot of the internet smarkies, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, the WLC, and you had, like, the little announce team with the little announce table and the little announce table spot, and you had, like, the teeny ladders, and you had, oh, it was just, it probably was the shining and probably, yeah, it's probably the shining moment for Drew McIntyre and Jinder Mahal's latter day career with the company, and yeah. It might have been their last stand, too, if I'm not mistaken.
It was set up to be a very goofy premise, like you're describing, but Hornswoggle and Torito went out there and killed it. And I mean, the man who is now El Torito, I had seen on an independent show a couple of years prior, and he stole the daggum show. And that was really the first and to this day, really the best chance that he really had to show what all he can do.
Oh, you? Do you want me to agree? I'll agree.
No, yeah, I was just holding out for the longest, most awkward silence.
But, you know, like I said, it's really, I think that's an interesting point, and I think it kind of goes back to the question that I asked earlier, is if you think about the biggest or the most significant events in that building, I think for whatever reason, maybe just because we're all kind of amateur, you know, historians in this, your mind goes back to the shows of 20 or 30 years ago. It doesn't focus on a big event from the past couple of years. Graham, do you think that carries over to now? Do you think, for instance, when it comes time to talk about the Superdome, I don't feel like WrestleMania 30 is as easy to overlook as some of the other more modern pay-per-views. So what makes something from the modern era stand out and be special and belong in that conversation to you?
Well, first of all, I will answer that, but going back to SummerSlam 07 real quick, one thing that's pretty significant that no one really talks about is the initial plan for that show. Do you guys remember what that first advertising poster was?
That's the Jackass SummerSlam.
Umaga versus Jackass.
Yeah, that's the Jackass SummerSlam. It was going to be him against, like, the whole cast or members of the cast.
Yep. And then they had their little bit on Raw, I think a few months before, kind of to lay that seed, and it did not go well. And that did not come to fruition. Now, your question was – try me one more time. I'm sorry.
Well, talking about, you know, shows in the modern era versus shows from 20 or 30 years ago, and we tend to hold those older shows in higher regard. But I think when it eventually on this program comes time to talk about the legendary cards at the Superdome, I don't think WrestleMania 30 will be overlooked in the same way that like a modern age SummerSlam would be. So what does a modern show need, what does it take for a modern show to be remembered in this era now where there's a pay-per-view and then there's Raw and then there's SmackDown and then there's another Raw and there's NXT specials where we're so saturated? What does it take for a modern major event to be remembered as one of the biggest events in the history of that venue, any given venue?
Well, I think it takes some planning. I think it takes a lot of planning, and it you have to make the fans care. They know they're going to get another show tomorrow. They're going to get a show the next week. So why is this show special? I think WrestleMania 30 hit all. It had so many high spots to it, and I don't mean the acrobatic style. It had a culmination of almost a year's buildup in that main event, with so many different players involved for so many different reasons. It just had so many things. It's kind of like this. It's kind of like the Great American Bash 89. You can watch that show and like that show for different reasons. Mm-hmm. And I think you kind of need that now. I think we run the risk now of planning for the next pay-per-view as soon as the previous pay-per-view was over. And there's good and bad to that. There's good because obviously you want to sell it. You want to create that reason that these guys are going to be having a match. But I think you also run the risk of pigeonholing these programs, such as a TLC pay-per-view, you know, at least you've got to get a chairs match, you've got to get a ladder match, you got to get a TLC match, and you don't. The system is not in place now to have those matches be built naturally. Now you're booking for a stipulation instead of having the feud culminate to the stipulation. And a lot of what we get now is of that variety. Now, that's not to say that everything that happened pre-1995 was gold, because it wasn't. We don't remember, you know, Random Wrestling Challenge from February 1990. We remember WrestleMania 6. And so I think it's a different makeup now. We don't remember random pay-per-view between, you know, WrestleMania 30 and Royal Rumble, or, you know, we don't remember random show between the two bigger shows. Mm-hmm. And I think that at the core, for any era, you just have to give these fans what they want in terms of giving. You have to appeal to every type of fan. The best shows are the shows that appeal to every different kind of fan, that have different matches, that have different stories, and they're all appealing. El Torito in the WLC match was appealing to a certain kind of fan. The Shield Evolution match was appealing to a certain kind of fan. Daniel Bryan Kane was appealing to a certain kind of fan. And the more variety of that you have in a show, the better the show is.
Yeah, I think that's a really good way of
putting it. It doesn't matter from what year it is.
Yeah, I think that's a really good way of putting it. And it's always something in producing events on the independents, I've always tried to do something for everyone.
Can I throw a couple other omissions that we haven't discussed? I don't know if you guys fondly remember No Way Out 2012, but No Way Out 2012 marked the end of People Power, if you remember the John Laurinaitis in power, being the GM of Raw and SmackDown and turning show heel for the 500th time and messing with Cena, and then Cena, if he wins, then Laurinaitis gets fired by Vince. But that wasn't even the show. That isn't even the most memorable match of the card. The most memorable match is probably one of the first kickoff show matches. And I'm talking about the Tuxedo match, which was also kind of in the same vein as WLC, although probably not nearly as well executed, between Santino Marella and Ricardo Rodriguez. I'd be remiss. Somebody on the internet would be like, how come you didn't mention the Tuxedo match in your first show? Well, there it is.
Yeah, I think that's really kind of another example of the modern shows just being more forgetful and more forgettable. I think if you know, someone were to pull that up on the network right now, you know, it could definitely be enjoyed and consumed, and you're like, wow, you know, this is not that bad. But it's just not it's not something that stayed with you past that night or that month, I think.
And I think that's just it's not just wrestling. I think it's just kind of our culture together. Mm-hmm. We can get anything we want whenever we want, so why pay attention to this right now when we can go back and watch it later? In talking with some folks on Facebook and Twitter leading into tonight's show, there were a few folks that had some pretty interesting personal accounts from the Meadowlands, and I wanted to share a couple of those. On Twitter, let's see, there's a account, and it's DVDVR with hyphen underscores between every letter. And he was telling me on Twitter that he attended the January 91 WCW show. Actually, I know another friend that was there personally, and I'll share that story first. A friend of mine that I knew from college, he was a little bit older, but he attended that show as a kid, and he was telling me that it was during a blizzard, huge snowstorm. I mean, that's why the attendance was so bad, is because people couldn't make it into the show. But he was kind of like standing outside waiting to get in or whatever, and word spread all amongst the crowd that there was going to be – they were changing the title. Before they even got in the building, there were a lot of strong rumors that Flair was taking the belt from Sting. So I thought that was pretty interesting. And so this guy on Twitter is saying that – and I was asking him if he had that same recollection. And he said that he actually called the arena every 30 minutes to make sure that they weren't going to cancel because of the inclement weather. And when they actually got in the building and saw the title change, he and his friend go, well, that's why they didn't cancel the show. They had to go ahead and switch the belt. So I thought that was pretty interesting. And then there was another guy by the name of, on Twitter, Dan Insinga. Sorry if I destroyed that. My name is also often destroyed, so I can relate. But he attended the July 91 – funny enough, these are both WCW shows – the July 91 show, the War Games show. And really interesting story that he sits down, and sitting right behind him was Cactus Jack in the crowd. And he later mentioned that to Cactus and on Twitter, and Cactus said, actually going to that show is what helped me get my job in WCW. And that time frame actually works out because he would be on TV about two months later. So he sat in the Meadowlands with Cactus Jack right behind him.
Very cool.
Yeah. So I thought those were pretty interesting. One thing that I wanted to do as kind of a weekly thing here on the show is hit on, outside of our main topic of discussion, is hit on some of our picks of the week. And we're going to be talking about a card of the week, a historical card of the week, a WWE Network pick of the week, something that you can check out on the network, and something that outside of the network that you can check out as our YouTube link of the week. Guys, which one wants to go first?
Let's go with YouTube first.
My YouTube link of the week, and we'll make sure to have this available when the show goes up, is actually a clip of it's from WCW Television, and it's actually highlights that we mentioned earlier from that January 1991 house show between the title change with Flair and Sting, and also has footage of Lawrence Taylor in Lex Luger's corner. And Lex Luger comes out for his match. I think it's against the Big Cat, who was Mr. Hughes, and he comes out dressed as a football player. I just want you to have that visual in your head. So we'll be sure to put that up with this the podcast on the Place to Be Nation when it goes live. Who's next?
Let's talk about that network pick. And I think it's I think it's one that we probably may have even sold them on prior to now. What do you think, Dan?
I say the network pick. We've been talking about it all night. What's gonna go, if you haven't already seen this show, it's a good starting point for the conversation that we had today. And that, of course, is SummerSlam 1989. It really is a show that starts off great. It really picks up there in the middle. With that Intercontinental title match that we talked about before, the main event is entertaining, if not necessarily for work rate, but just for the entertainment value and the big name characters. And everything that was supposed to be long was right there on target. Nothing was over 20 minutes. Everything that was supposed to be short or deemed as offensive was kept short. Heck, you even get the little Easter egg of Ron Garvin doing some horrific ring announcing. So if that hasn't sold you, that you should probably just check it out. It's really easy to find. Just go to the WWE section, the pay-per-views, and of course, 1989, you'll see SummerSlam right there. So that's our pick of the week here at History of Wrestling.
Two points I want to piggyback off that is, one, Hart Foundation versus the Brainbusters should have been a six-month program, and I would have watched every single one of those matches. I love that match. Two, WWEshop.com needs to make a Ron Garvin, the winner by a disqualification, the Mighty Hercules t-shirt.
Strongly agree with that. That's yes. One of my favorite moments of the show.
Amen.
And it's one word. It combines all the words into one word, and then it's got a picture of him in his tuxedo.
Yes. Barbershop window, WWE, somebody needs to get on this.
Graham, and pro wrestling tees, that could be part of your catalog.
Absolutely can.
we if someone else does it, we get 50% of the cut. We get a finder's fee. So card of the week, who's got that?
I got the classic card of the week, and it's from the History of Professional Wrestling, Jim Crockett Promotions and the NWA title, page 168. It's the first Star Wars card in the Meadowlands, February 24th, 1985. 18,600 fans paying $180,000. This was a product of the AWA and NWA coming together and trying to hold off the storm of the WWF and WrestleMania. So on one card, you had Jimmy Valiant and the Young Bloods brothers against Zbyszko, Bockwinkel, and Dory Funk. You had Kamala. You had Bob Backlund against Billy Robinson, the High Flyers, Gagne and Brunzell against Mr. Saito and the Masked Superstar, Ivan and Nikita Koloff against Steve Kern and Jimmy Valiant, subbing for Stan Lane, Jimmy Garvin and the AWA World Heavyweight Champion Rick Martel, AWA World Tag Champs, the Road Warriors against Jerry Lawler and Baron Von Raschke, NWA World Champ Ric Flair against Harley Race, and a lot of the guys from throughout the card come back for a big tag team battle royal. I think that should be the classic card of the week because it really showcases, number one, all the amazing talent that came through the Meadowlands, and number two, it really shows that it was at the time, at this time in wrestling's history, with the other promoters, it was all hands on deck trying to hold off WrestleMania and hold off the storm of the WWF. Once again, that's page 168 in the History of Professional Wrestling, Jim Crockett Promotions, and the NWA World Heavyweight Title, also at thehistoryofwwe.com. Graham Coffin, where can they pick up the History of Professional Wrestling books, such as this Crockett Promotions book that features this and all the other cards that Crockett ran in the Meadowlands?
Funny enough, I know the answer to that. There are a few ways. One is check out thehistoryofwwe.com. There are links out there if you're in the U.S., Canada, or England, or I'm sorry, the UK, more than England. You can get them right there. Volumes 1 through 5, most recently, is 50 years of WWE at Madison Square Garden, every show ever, plus photos and stories and ticket stubs and lineup sheets. So you can go there. You can go to Amazon.com, or you can go to BarnesandNoble.com. Now, if you walk in a Barnes & Noble and you cannot find the book in the store, ask for it. But you can get it off their website anytime you want. So be sure to check out those books. We do have on the history of WWE.com right now a direct link that will take you to our Pro Wrestling Tees store. So there's three different designs up there right now. One in particular is getting a lot of love. And I don't know if you guys have seen it yet, but it's a my favorite subject is history, and it's a chalkboard. And you've got the ring drawn in chalk on the chalkboard. That one's getting a lot of love. I noticed my favorite teacher, Matt Stryker, even retweeted my tweet about that yesterday. So thank you, Matt Stryker. So check those out. We're going to be hopefully adding some more designs as we progress. Guys, you want to tell folks how they can find you on Twitter?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Stutzy, S-T-U-T-T-S-Y.
And contrary to me flubbing it earlier, my Twitter is at DMACP2B. That's D-M-A-C, P number 2B. And we're just trying like mad to catch up to Steve Carino's baby. So if I can just reach him, that'll be the start of the revolution that is my Twitter following.
Well, what's the difference in numbers right now?
I'm embarrassed to say it's over 120 and growing because people don't follow me so often. Maybe this show will be my platform for it.
Oh, it will. We will change that. We will change that. And you can also follow me at the History of WWE on Twitter. Make sure you use the hashtag HOW podcast. That stands for History of Wrestling Podcast. And I want to thank everyone for joining us for our first show. Thank you, Brad. Thank you, Dan. Had a ton of fun. We'll be back soon with another big historical issue to talk about. See you guys then.